Good morning. Let me call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, April 10th to order. We have eight items. The first is here a presentation discuss and provide direction on a residential rental property inspection program.
Mayor and Council, I will start the discussion on this item. Last month, we had a study session and discussed this issue, and the council directed staff to bring back some ordinances for consideration. These will, as you know, what we've proposed are some charter amendment changes. These will have to be presented to the voters under our charter. What council asked for was to grant council the same authority as provided under state law. Council did not want it limited to multi-housing family residential property, so we have drafted it with different levels of flexibility, and we brought it back for council direction. One of the issues we weren't sure what council's direction was last time is if you wanted to limit it just to individual residential property programs or if you wanted the authority for a citywide program, which is also established under state statute. If we go with that version or alternative here in the packet, it would still have to come back to council at some point to establish the program. This just grants council the authority to establish the program under state law. So we presented three different options for your consideration. We can just open it up for discussion now, and I guess at the end of the day, we'd like direction which, if any, of these options you would like brought forward for introduction and consideration at council meetings, which would ultimately end up with it on the ballot in November.
Okay. Do you have a presentation too, Mike?
No, Mayor, we did not. Okay.
There was in the backup material, it said, if the city establishes a citywide inspection program, it cannot establish a licensing and or registration requirement for rental properties. I thought, would a licensing and registration program for rentals be part of a citywide inspection program if it was done on just rentals? Would there have to be a component that would have to have a registration program that ties into this?
No, Mayor, I believe how that would work is I think the state statute was saying cities, you can do this, but it does not allow you to either charge a fee for these inspections or to establish a licensing or registration process. What rental properties are already required to do under state statute is to register with the county assessor. The cities would then are authorized by state statute to ask the assessor for a listing of all residential rental properties in the city of Mesa. We would obtain that list, and if we're going to use or establish a citywide program, we would use that list to set our schedule on when the properties would be inspected.
All right. Okay, what's your pleasure? Councilmember Jones.
Just moving on, how often do we check that list? Do we get one? Do we follow that process so that we know if they're registered or not or licensed?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Jones, typically it's typically complaint driven, that process. If we receive a complaint that an individual property is not registered with the county, then we'll investigate that and send letters to that property owner informing them that they are required to register with the county. But we do not obtain a list of those properties. It's more of a reactive response than a proactive.
Would it be wise to probably periodically have that list so that when we do have complaints, we could compare it right away instead of waiting to get a list and have it delayed longer? I mean, there are times we get calls regarding a property saying, hey, it's a rental property now or group home, whatever, and we don't know, and, well, we can't verify.
And we have access to the county assessor's information, the database, so to speak, so we can pull that information at a moment's notice, but it would be wise to have that list in advance. Okay. And we will do that.
On a residential rental, is it more than two or three units? I'm not sure I remember the nuance of the law where you have to collect a sales tax, and I don't know if there's a state one and a city one, but there's some trigger number that comes to play, and I just won't remember what it is. So something could be a rental, but if you didn't reach a certain threshold, you wouldn't know. I also thought that a rental property was a different assessment rate than an owner-occupied. So you could also look at, see how it was assessed the prior year, or whether. So can you kind of update me, or does anybody know the nuances to the different ones?
Mayor, what the standard is, if you have three or more properties anywhere in the state that's rental property, you're required to pay tax on that rental property.
Does that also trip a different assessment value? Does it go from 10% to 15% or 20% then on some of the computations?
That part I'm not aware of, but I know that it is a different rate, and I know that it triggers when a person has three or more properties, and that's anywhere in the state, not just in the city.
Okay, so three or more requires, so if we approve one of these on a rental, are we also going to the three or more? Is that tied into state law, or is it any rental? And because if it's three or more, you're not going to have the database down to one or two. Is that correct? Am I on the right? I'm just trying to figure out how to follow up with Councilmember Jones, how you're really going to track these from a county list or some other list. Who has a list that would apply to state law for one rental, and you being able to know where it's at and that it is a rental property or it isn't?
Mayor, I might answer that. ARS, excuse me, ARS 33-1902A says that an owner of residential rental property shall maintain with the assessor in the county where the property is located information required, and it lists the name, address, telephone number of the property owner. So I think under this statute, if you have one rental property, you're required to notify the county assessor.
Okay, so that trips it to the higher rate. Okay, Vice Mayor.
Mayor, I want to follow up on a couple of your questions. First of all, the requirement for three rental properties or more is a City of Mesa requirement. That's not state. We are the ones who collect sales tax. The state doesn't collect sales tax on these rentals. We do. So I didn't know it was anywhere in the state that you own rental properties, that it was three or more of residential. But I do know that in the City of Mesa, that's something we have. And in fact, I've thought it's something that we need to look at. I'm not sure why somebody who owns a duplex that they rent out should be in a different state than somebody who owns a triplex. I understand that if you have one rental property, you may be moving from one house to another. You haven't sold your house yet. But, you know, that was one of those things on our list of things that I wanted to get done before I left that I wanted to look at. And that is that number, that threshold of three. I think a threshold of two would be more appropriate. I looked at Arizona multi-housing and asked them about it. They didn't have a problem with that. In fact, they would rather see consistency on it rather than not. In terms of registering, you are required to register with the county, but there are people who don't. I mean, it happens all the time, but there are people who also, as we well know, who also don't get a transaction privilege tax license, who need one, and so it's one of those things that the county has to stay on top of. But if we become aware of something, we also might want to develop a closer relationship with the county to make sure that we report to them that we're aware of something being a rental property.
And Mayor and Vice Mayor, the statute also indicates that if someone fails to register with the county, the city has the authority to cite them for failing to comply if after proper notice and time to come into compliance they refuse or fail to do so.
Well, can't we get the county? I mean, maybe the sheriff could come and cite them?
Mm-hmm. We could probably.
Just a thought. May I follow up on, did you want to ask some more questions on that, or because I had a question on this?
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Debbie, I'm looking at alternative number one, because in terms of the language, alternative number one feels like it's just the cleanest language there. But I wondered if there was any ambiguity in it by saying unless authorized by state law. Are we suggesting that Mesa specifically has to be authorized by state law? I looked at that a couple of times last night and thought, okay, now, is that a problem because it's so simple? Does it imply that Mesa has to be authorized by state law?
I don't believe so. In my opinion, what this says is any program authorized by state law, because anyone, you know, the state law never authorizes a specific city. It says a city or town within the state may. That would include the city of Mesa. So as written, I believe this would allow the council or would provide the council the authority to implement any program for residential rental, any program for inspections under state law.
Okay.
The first alternative that's written, that you just read is, well, when I compare one to two, under number two, it says this would include both the citywide program and the individual program, but I'm assuming then that alternative one does not. And I'm looking at on page three of the report.
No, Mayor, actually, it was intended to be that one, option one, is broader than option two, because option two is expressly authorizes the council to establish residential rental inspection programs. Option one would include those as well as any other program that the state may authorize. At this point, the state only authorizes residential rental inspection programs. It could go beyond that at some point. It doesn't right now.
All right, that was confusing because that one line said this would include both the citywide and the individual program, so I'm assuming that alternative one didn't.
Okay, I apologize. Actually, one is more broad than option two.
Okay, all right. And what would be the sequence of events then? This would go on a ballot, and then the council would then have the authorization to do something, and then could, if they so wanted to work out a program, do it, and figure out if there was
within the state
within pertaining, you know, in the realms of what state law allows, and then we would look at setting up a program on a complaint basis or whatever it is and figure out how many inspectors it would take to do it and then assign a fee to that, or can fees be assigned for inspections, or there would be no fees? It's all going to be a budget item.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what we would do first, council would, if it desires, instruct us to introduce one of these options. It would be introduced as every other ordinance is. 2 weeks later, we'd come back and council would consider it. If council approved it, it would then be placed on the November ballot. And if it's approved by the voters, with regard to the individual rental inspection program, I think it could be implemented without specific ordinances being drafted by the staff and brought back to council. We could do that if council wants it, but state law does not require an ordinance. On the contrary, for a citywide program, what the state law says is that you can do this, but it has to be established through an ordinance and it has to go through a public review process. So for the citywide program, it would have to come back and council would have to decide if you actually want to implement it or not. But Mayor, you're correct. It does have budget impacts. Under the statute, we are not allowed to impose a fee for the inspections unless we've done an inspection, we've identified violations, no fee is permitted for that inspection. We go back and for the second inspection, if violations are corrected, we are not allowed to impose a fee for that inspection. It's only if the property owner fails or refuses to come into compliance that at some point the statute does allow the city to impose a fee for those inspections.
Okay, and as state law changes, if they make modifications to it, then we just stay in compliance with it and don't have to send through another change to the ballot.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. I believe I'm in favor of going with alternative one. Other discussion? All right. Do we bring this back then for council action?
The direction I'm hearing is that we will place on the next council agenda for introduction alternative one.
Let me just ask one question about this, and that is that I know that under state law that you cannot go and inspect somebody's property without permission of the owner of the property, permission or permission of the person who's occupying the tenant, the property, or you have to have a court order. It's one of those things. When this goes on the ballot, I'm assuming that the ballot language will look like what you have here in alternative one, only, well, actually, you're just going to have a tag that says slum landlord law. But in the description, in the ballot argument, or in the description someplace, now I'm looking over here at Linda, can that be articulated that says, you know, under state law, these things have to happen? I know I've been asked that question a couple of times, and I just want to make sure that when that information pamphlet goes out, that people are aware that under the existing state law, that those conditions have to exist.
Well, Vice Mayor, as you know, because it is the November ballot, we're only going to be allowed taglines.
Right.
But in the publicity pamphlet, I'll defer to the city attorney, I don't see any reason why that type of language and explanation cannot be included. Outlined in it so that all the citizens will be able to read it, but also be posted in all the polling places, although it will not be all on the ballot.
And I see the disadvantage of doing that is that it states that, and then they change state law. So you have
sure.
to refer to what's currently in state right. law. So I think it's better in the publicity pamphlet under existing state law.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, that's why I said under current right. state law, this right. is, but I think the tagline is just going to say slum landlord law. Thank you.
Tom.
Well, isn't this much more than a slum landlord law? I mean, if the city adopts it, if we set up a citywide program, isn't it every rental property in the city is going to be inspected on a regular basis, including ones that have stellar performances? And it's not a complaint-driven process, as I understand it.
Councilmember Rawls, you're correct. Under option one, which would give the city authority under both the individual rental program, which is complaint-driven.
Right.
But it also authorizes the citywide program, which is not complaint-driven. It is a periodic review,
thorough review of every rental property in the city, and therefore it's not just directed at slums. I just want the tagline to be accurate.
And we haven't even begun to talk about how we would draft the tagline. But
yeah, but the momentum has started. Right. The rock started down the hill.
Vice Mayor.
Okay, but according to what I heard you say, Debbie, in order to get the kind of program, by the way, I didn't bring, what I brought forward was what I talked about. So let's make that clear. And what I heard Debbie say was, if you're going to go with that program, you're going to have to adopt an ordinance. There would have to be a public hearing process. You'd have to go through city council to adopt an ordinance to go with that program that you're talking about, Tom. So passing this would allow them to adopt an ordinance that does that, but it would not adopt the ordinance that does it.
I understand that as well, but I just think if you're going to have something on the ballot for the people to decide, it shouldn't be if it also grants authority for the development of a periodic, comprehensive inspection program that's not necessarily slum landlord driven or slum driven or blight driven. The tagline ought to say that and not just be thrown out there with all the little nuances and palpitations that go with slum landlord law. That's all I'm saying. I think it ought to be more honest than that.
I think you're better off unless you cite all state law and housing codes that are applicable to what is being passed. It's going to be confusing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, because you could...
There are ways of saying just, you know, resident rental inspection program, whatever. There's ways of saying it other than the emotional catchphrase that doesn't cover all of the possibilities. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Scott?
I'm curious, Debbie, this is probably just speculation, but between alternative one and two, the difference in the language under two specifically says residential rental inspection program. You don't see that anywhere in alternative one. Now, state law only has a residential rental inspection program. What other possibilities, insidious possibilities, are out there that the state could implement that people might not find palatable?
Well, they would authorize. But
well, I guess I'm not sure what the state might contemplate or what people may or may not find palatable, but I think under option one, mm-hmm. Answering your question, that could include any type of program. It may just be residential inspection programs. You know, the state now does not have it, but let's assume at some point the state passed a residential inspection program. this council would then have authority to implement that as well under option one.
So owner-occupied residential inspection program.
If that were ever passed under state law, that would also be authorized under option one.
I'm having some difficulty with that. It's not legal. There's no state law there. I don't see that happening. But the possibility of state law changing and the voters not having the opportunity to say, wait a minute, I agree with that. We should have a rental I agree we should have a residential inspection program or rental. The idea of people getting their head of the bathtub ring police coming in and inspecting their own houses that they occupy just may not be palatable enough. And alternative two, that specifically states residential rental inspection program may be better if there's change in state law and there's the feeling by future council that they want to adopt that particular program, then it probably should go back before the voters. Something for discussion there.
Vice Mayor.
I agree with Council Member Summers. I'll tell you why I had looked at alternative one. I wasn't sure, Debbie, if the language in alternative two would encompass the existing provision for slum property designation. Does it?
Yes, it does, because it refers also to residential rental programs. So, yes, in my opinion, Title 33 would also be included in Alternative 2.
Okay. Well, and the difference between Alternative 2 and Alternative 3 is that Alternative 3 only deals with the situation. Alternative 3 is what I originally brought forward. But then I heard you all say that you wanted more flexibility on it. So I concur with Council Member Summers about the concern on alternative one. I think when we have to go out and talk to the voters about this, that's going to be the question that's raised. I think that's opening the door too wide. So I actually agree with you, Council Member Summers. I know that's shocking. Oh wait, that would be Council Member Rawls. That would be shocking. I am willing to go back to alternative three, which is the one that I brought forward.
Yeah.
I'm in favor of
everything. Well, my question for Tom, would alternative two ease your heartburn?
No, because I'm talking about what's on the ballot.
Of how it's presented.
How
on
it's presented. I just want it fair. My preference, if we're going to have any one of these three, is alternative three, and I'm agreeing with Councilmember Walker's here, because I think it's the most restrictive. Because this whole area troubles me from a libertarian standpoint. So I'd prefer number three, but however it is, whichever one of the options, if you just put on the tagline implementation of the establishment or the authority to establish a slum landlord, as Debbie just said, that's a part of it. But that's not all of it, and I don't think you ought to label a whole package that just deals with part of it. But I prefer option three, quite frankly.
And the difference being you have individual residential as opposed to just residential.
Right, right, which is the complaint-driven process as opposed to the periodic, comprehensive, regular inspection program, which I have serious trouble with.
Trying to think through the differences between two and three is, well, I can agree with the complaint driven. I suppose the concern I would have from the city's perspective is since there's going to be folks who fear retribution, we may not get the complaints. And so at least having some level of the ability for staff to do inspections of properties they feel are blighted adds that extra level of protection and oversight. The other reason to feel a little bit more comfortable with that is that we just don't have the resources, either fiscal or manpower, to inspect the Waldorf. Not that we have one, but
we're not going to be inspecting the dead properties. It would be a waste of time. So I could certainly agree with three. I guess if I were going to put it this way, one is out, two is good, three is fine. And as far the for the tagline, I think of the subject of this council report says residential rental inspection program. Sounds like a good tagline to me. And we just go with that one.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Debbie, let me ask you the question about three that I asked you previously. Would this have any impact on our ability to implement the existing slum property designation?
No, Vice Mayor. I believe that even option three would include Title 33, the slum property, because, again, it, too, identifies residential slum property designation.
Okay, I'm going to Councilmember Summers' concern that people would fear retribution. Does it say who has to be the complaining party? I mean, the state law says that we have to have permission of those or court order. Could the complaining party be the city?
Well, the complaint can come from any individual or entity, but to inspect the property, you're going to have the consent of the owner, the occupant, or a court order.
Right. So the complaint doesn't have to come from one of those people. The complaint could come from a neighbor. The complaint could come from a council member. You know, the complaint could come from a lot of different places. I think in terms of, and I'm going to correct what I said a minute ago. I think the concern, and Darrell, I think you raised the concern about whether or not what I was suggesting was multi-residential, and you said why not a single property, and I think that was the concern that you had raised. So I think that was one of the complicating factors in what I had brought forward. But this would address both a single rental home property as well as multi-units.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Then if you need a motion, Mayor, I will move that we move alternative three forward bring it forward for an ordinance to the council.
Mm-hmm. Is there a second? All right. Motion second. Discussion on it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Moves forward. Tom?
Following up on the conditions that 9-1302 impose, I'm assuming that if there's under E where it says there's probable cause, this is on the second page of the council report. It's probably the easiest place to find it in. You've summarized it there. I'm assuming that who makes the determination of a finding of probable cause under state law? Is that a court or is that a code compliance officer? I know it has to be a court if the owner or tenant refuse access, but are we setting our code compliance officers up as quasi-judicial officers by making findings of probable cause?
Yeah. Councilmember Rawls, there's no answer in there. I think what we would do practically is we would be talking among ourselves. Code compliance would come to the city attorney's office and the prosecutor's office, and we would be discussing that issue.
Okay. Because as I read this statute, I'm glad that we went this route, of any of them, but I think this statute just has more ambiguity in it. I mean, what is a significant level of crime associated with the property mean? If they're a victim of a drive-by shooting, does that authorize entrance into the interior for inspection purposes, not an investigation? You know, I think we need to be careful how we interpret this statute, because I think it's very vague and subject to abuse.
Okay, move on to number two, which is hear a presentation and discuss library budget issues.
Council. I am Heather Wolf. I'm the library director for the City of Mesa Library. Next to me is Don Kusarak, our library management assistant, and behind us we have Kate Havris, our assistant library director. The three of us are here to provide a quick overview of the library's mission, our budget history, the proposed fiscal year 08-09 reductions, as well as a brief update on library performance measures and service improvements. like to set the stage by reading our mission statement. By providing access and guidance to information, services, and resources, the City of Mesa libraries expand minds, empower individuals, and enrich our diverse community. This next slide is a brief budget history. It starts in fiscal year 04-05. You will see at that time we had 168.3 FTEs, and we expended over $10.1 million. Moving to last fiscal year 06-07, FTE count decreased to 121.4, and we expended $8.7 million. This fiscal year, we have 121.6 FTEs, and if anyone's wondering, we eliminated one vacant position, reallocated the budget salary amounts, and upgraded a number of our 0.5 part-time positions to 0.6 FTEs, and that's why we went up slightly to a point by 0.2 in that fiscal year for our FTE count. Based on 7 months of data, we're projecting to expend about $8.9 million this fiscal year. Next fiscal year, with the budget reductions that are proposed, we will have 116.6 FTEs, and the budgeted amount for the library at that time is $10.4 million. Hi, Clyde.
Hi. Mayor, may I ask?
Please.
Okay. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that you have dropped 50-plus FTEs and your budget has gone up slightly.
Okay.
Is that capital? I mean, what's going on there that's driving that?
If you go back to the forecast, personnel costs
go up approximately 4% per year. Uh-huh. So you're talking about a 16%, that four-year period, a 16% compounding rate. So that is very, very possible.
Okay, but look at 07-08 to 08-09.
Right. One is projected expenditures. We already have saved over $700,000 in vacancy savings this year. Our budget is 10.7. We're not going to expend that amount.
Remember,
this year.
Remember, okay. we asked them to hold the line for this year. Okay. But some of those positions will be filled.
It's budgeted versus actual.
Correct. So we've got a little bit of apples and oranges on this chart.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Okay. Our next slide shows how the library allocates our funds. As you can see, three quarters of it is devoted to personnel. Our next biggest piece of the pie are our subscriptions and materials budgets. For your information, subscriptions are our magazines, newspaper, microfilm, microfiche, and electronic resources. The materials budget are the print materials and the audiovisual materials, books and audiovisual. Our commodities and other services are 6% and 5% respectively. We've prepared a summary of our proposed reductions. There are five of them. Two are related to the subscriptions and materials budgets. The other three are related to vacant positions. When totaled up, it's almost $500,000 that we'll be reducing out of next year's proposed budget. The first proposed reduction is to reduce the subscriptions by $28,000. The impact to our residents, we will be purchasing fewer subscriptions and we will be offering fewer titles, magazines, newspapers, microfilm, and electronic resources. The next proposed reduction is to reduce the media materials budget by $133,000. Again, we'll be purchasing fewer copies of a single title. Essentially, the bestsellers will be purchasing fewer copies of each bestseller. And then we will purchase fewer titles overall. I think the simplest explanation of that is if there are five Italian cookbooks that come out next fiscal year, we'll probably purchase two or three, not all five titles. Fiscal year 08-09, Our estimated materials expenditure per capita is $3.12. What that means is when you combine the subscriptions budget and the materials budget, we will be, and then divide it by the population, we will be spending $3.12 per Mesa resident on materials at the library. We have prepared a chart to explain a little bit more about the significance of that number. As you can see, in fiscal year 04-05, the library spent $3.43 per resident on books and magazines, newspapers, etc. In 05-06, that number went to $3.62 with a lot of help from the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community, who donated $250,000 for the purchase of children's materials that fiscal year and helped us bring that number up considerably. The following fiscal year, in 06-07, we spent $3.28 per resident. Again, the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community was generous to the library, and they gave us $50,000 to spend on lifelong learning materials, and that helped us. Otherwise, we only would have been spending $3.17 per resident. This fiscal year, we anticipate spending $3.27 per resident. That's taking what is budgeted by the budget office for our materials and subscriptions and any realized savings that we have elsewhere in our operating expenditures. We are moving over to our materials budget to keep that number up as best we can this fiscal year. Next fiscal year, with the reductions of the $28,000 to the subscriptions and the $133,000 to the media materials budget, that number will go down to $3.12. This number allows us to compare, obviously, against our past performance, but it's also a number that public libraries use to compare against each other, and that's the reference to the $3.98. The Public Library Association groups the City of Mesa Library in a category of libraries that serve populations of 250,000 to 499,999. If you're wondering who all might be in that group with us, it's Omaha, Oakland, Minneapolis, other cities that are similar size. If we wanted to be in the 50th percentile of libraries in that serving that population size, we would be expending $3.98. So you can see that when compared to other libraries, our performance is dropping. Do we have any questions about that? Okay. All right. We're moving next to the proposed position reductions. We would reduce librarian positions. There are three vacant librarian positions for a total savings of almost $174,000. That savings is both salary and benefits. And the impact, we would reduce the number of librarians at the main library's customer service desks. It's the loss of about 90 hours per week. Our next proposed reduction is actually in progress. The main library's periodicals room staff went from 5 to 4 in December and is now down to 3. We are eliminating the 1.8 FTE vacant positions related to that for a savings of $87,000. We will reduce the 6 service desks at the main library to 5. To move the magazines, the newspapers, the back issues, microfilm, microfiche, and equipment to the first floor, and so not eliminate the service, we did have to reconfigure the first floor, which resulted in the elimination of a leisure seating area, and we've also reduced the subscriptions from 550 to 400. Our final proposed reduction is to reduce an administrative staff position. Our management assistant one position became vacant in October. Those duties have been reabsorbed by the remaining three of us. And so that is another reduction that's essentially already taken place. Now I'd like to update you on some of the library's performance measures, beginning with annual circulation. This
Heather,
number...
Before you go to the performance
sure.
issues, just this is actually, Chuck, you should probably come up for this question. I'm going to raise the question because Dave asked me, so I think it's... So Dave's leaving now. In terms of what is counted in the library's budget and their FTEs and all of those things, it is people who are directly hired by the library who are under the FTEs. So the librarians, the people who shelve books, the people who check things in and check things out, the security personnel who are at the library, those would not be under the library's jurisdiction, but they would be in the budget number.
In this budget number, this is their direct cost. Municipal security is the direct cost of the police department at this time. They charge their program from a financial program. So
this number does not have the costs that are charged out of the other departments in it?
Correct. This is their direct.
So what I told you was wrong, David.
Because we do, and this is a good question to ask, we do things two ways in the city of Mesa.
Yeah.
We do it direct budgets. And then we do full program costing.
So this is not their full program
costing? This is not their full program costing from a financial program standpoint. This is their direct cost.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked the question because I just gave Dave some really bad information.
What we're doing on the general governmental side is we present what they have direct control over from an administrative standpoint.
Okay.
But Chuck, we were able to do... a reduction like this, though, on municipal
yes.
security in the art center.
Yes, we did.
We talked about how that worked.
What we did on that one was we presented that one since it's more of an enterprise fund. See, this is where we get a little bit confusing, is when we have something that we consider an enterprise, we present it from a full cost financial program basis because you should see how that program is operating. This is a general governmental area coming right out of the general fund, supported by quality of life and by general fund dollars. So we give them the direct resources. What we were able to do with the MAC was, since we're presenting from a full cost standpoint and there's some general fund support from the old MAC that was still contributed, we reduced resources in the police department that would have hit their program. So we actually reduced some resources out of PD and reduced that transfer to support that program in the general fund from the MAC.
But we do know, you know, and you said things that impact, that they can impact directly. But we do know that there are things that we can impact directly. For instance, a few years ago when we went to emptying our own trash on the seventh floor, and it saved hundreds of thousands of dollars a year
yes.
for us to do that. Those kinds of things can be impacted directly by a department.
Absolutely. And we do kind of measure that, as you'll see as we go forward with summarization on May 1st and so forth. We can give you a number of what was our impact on overhead cost by what we've done in reductions. So that would kind of give you a measure. They've been cut out of general fund areas, but what impact does that have on other areas around the city?
And how are you helping the departments to feel buy-in to that?
Well, typically when we start these discussions, that's the first thing they bring up, cut someone else.
that's what I'm thinking.
So that's how that works.
Yeah, or doesn't.
Yes.
So, Chris, that's your job.
Yeah, and Chuck and I have had this conversation. We continue to need to review how we allocate the overhead throughout the departments because I appreciate the concept that Mesa tries to follow to do full cost accounting for programs. But at some level, it becomes a very large burden that, I don't know, sometimes I question if it's applicability on all programs. But I think it's something we need to look at. We know that as we move forward in updating our financial system, that's something we're going to have to look at. I mean, all the costs are covered. It's just a matter of where do you show the burden of that in the budget. It doesn't mean that we're not showing it. It's just how much of that do you actually allocate out to the departments, and is that burden truly reflective of their overhead responsibility? And I think some of the departments... what's interesting is the departments become more familiar with their budgets and the sensitivity to what they can reduce and what they can't control. That overhead number becomes a significant factor. So it also makes sure that we stay in balance with both direct service operations and their budget impact, as well as all those costs around it. So if we're having to adjust operations costs, reduce those down, we also need to go back and look at our overhead costs and make sure those are proportionally being reduced at the same time.
Exactly. And that was the point. So I gather that, like, my entire salary is probably under the library since I, you know, use the library.
Just a little piece.
Exactly. Oh, okay. How it works.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I was just vamping till the mayor got back. Oh. Just kidding. Scott?
I'd have helped you out a little bit over here. Maybe this question's best directed toward Chuck. You might know the answer to this, but my wife was remarking the other day that it seems more convenient. We live in Southeast Mesa to use the county library that's in Gilbert than it is to try to drive up to Red Mountain or have to drive all the way into downtown Mesa to use the library. So she's been a patron of the county library system. It seems that the county's collecting a lot of revenue out of Mesa for their libraries, and we're not getting a whole lot in return. Do we know what those numbers are as far as what's being contributed to Mesa as opposed to what's being leached out?
I'm fully aware of that, but I think Heather's the better technical person to answer that question.
For people who aren't aware of what Scott is referring to, the library district does have a tax on your property tax. And the Maricopa Library District was created with that tax. The county has two functions. They do operate libraries in smaller communities, but they also run a reciprocal borrowing program, with the idea being that any Maricopa County resident may use any Maricopa County library that's convenient to them. So, just as your family, there's no Mesa library close to you, so you can go use the Gilbert libraries for free. There's no charge, even though you're not a Gilbert resident. So that's one of the things that your tax dollars are getting for you. Specifically, as regards to Mesa, I know that it's been a little while since the numbers were run, but I think when we've totaled it in the past, Mesa residents contribute between $1 and $2 million to the library district. What the City of Mesa Library gets out of that directly is we get a courier system that runs among all the libraries in the county for moving books, interlibrary loan books, back and forth among the libraries. We do get about $80,000 worth of electronic resources that we do not pay for. The library district does pay for those. You'll see in a later slide that we are working with the library district on our summer reading program this year. They're going to purchase all of our prizes, all the promotional materials, and do all the marketing for us. So at no cost to us, we simply distribute the materials at our libraries as part of our summer reading program.
Heather, it's fair to say that we are a donor city to the county program.
Correct. And
we don't get back
any
percentage. It's not a significant percentage.
And the services you were referring to, the moving of the books, the electronics, that's not going to do us a whole lot of good, because at some point, with the continued reduction in the budget to the library, we're going to have to start talking about closing Southwest and East Mesa Library, the Dobson and Red Mountain. We know that's coming. It's just a matter of when. So it's not going to do us a heck of a lot of good. We have a property tax, if you will, not the city, but there's a county property tax for libraries that's going to libraries, and I believe one of those small communities you had referred to is Paradise Valley, one of the small communities?
They may be negotiating with the library district. I'm not sure. Youngtown and Wickenburg are coming up online with the county.
Well, I wouldn't mind Wickenburg having one, but the idea of North Scottsdale and Paradise Valley having a community library, and they're amongst the wealthiest communities, it's a little odd. All right.
Thank you.
All right. The next slide is our annual circulation. We've kind of got two things going on that slide. The columns are the circulation numbers over the last several fiscal years. The little line going across the top, just to give you some perspective, those are the hours that the library was open, because as you're aware, we've had some reductions in hours over the last several fiscal years. So when you look back at fiscal year 2004-05, the libraries were open 62 hours per week at each location for a total of 9,672 hours, and we circulated over 3.1 million items. The next fiscal year, we had a reduction in hours. You may remember in April of 06, we reduced the branch library hours to 46 hours per week because of staffing reductions. We circulated 2.5 million items that year. The following year, we saw an 18% decrease in our circulation. And you can see the full effect over the year of the reduction in hours at the branch locations. We circulated just over 2 million items. This fiscal year, we are anticipating a slight increase of about 2.7%. We're very excited about that. I think people are realizing that the libraries did not close. They are still there. We're trying to do things to get people in the doors and checking out materials because that's what we're here to do.
Mm-hmm. When you go through a slide, I think we can all read the numbers and see the trend line. So, and we've got two other presentations. Okay, if you can speed it up a little bit,
certainly.
I appreciate it.
I can do that.
Thank you.
Okay. The next slide is our annual in-house visits. And as you can see, we have declined a little bit. The decrease in in-house visits is not as drastic as in our circulation. We've gone from 1.2 over the last several fiscal years to 1.15. So people are still coming through the doors. They're just not checking out as many items. And you can see that relationship shown better on the next slide, where we have the ratio of circulation per library visit. Fiscal year 04-05, we circulated about 2.6 items per library visit. In 07-08, the number is 1.83. A lot of that has to do with the change in technology. People are coming to the library for reasons other than just checking out materials. Moving into our service improvements, we've done a number of things over the last 18 months to adapt to the reductions in staff that we've had. We've consolidated service desks at the Dobson location. We've reduced the number of staff circulation stations at our other locations by adding self-check machines. Essentially, we're forcing people to do self-service and replacing staff with machines. Currently, a self-checkout handles 58% of our checkout. We've also increased our public access internet terminals from 109 to 130, again, trying to give people what they want. And in February, we were able to implement wireless access at all three locations so that our visitors with laptops can use those rather than the public internet terminals to conduct their business. For those of you who are on council currently, you've approved a number of contracts for us to implement radio frequency identification technology. If you remember, it automates our check-in. It's going to help us identify items out of order, really help us with staff efficiencies. And we have estimated completion dates. Dobson, we hope to complete at the end of this month. We're waiting to install some security gates. And then Maine and Red Mountain, hopefully we'll complete the conversion in December of 2009. In our programming area, we've reinstated our summer reading programs. Based on demand, we've increased children's story times at Maine and Red Mountain to twice weekly. And we've reinstated adult programming with great success. We've hosted several signature events, and we're looking to do this every year. July of 07, we had the Harry Potter Night Owl celebration and had 325 people attend that. And our community festival in February brought over 1,500 people to the Maine Library. We've been proactive in seeking grants. The grants you see before you were specifically to fund RFID at the Maine Library this fiscal year. And we're also working with our other Valley libraries and participating in some consortiums. The Greater Phoenix Digital Library Consortium, we pay $24,000, and as a result, receive access to $400,000 worth of downloadable audiobooks, music, and video because of the Valley Libraries partnering together for that. With the help of the PIO office, we've gotten some sponsorships this year, which is a new thing for us. You can see Bookman's, MCC Alumni Association, and SRP have been very generous to us in funding the More Than a Century of Service celebration this year. The Friends have also been proactive this year, and you can see where they've been donating their money to the library this year. Finally, I cannot end the presentation without speaking about our volunteers. Vice Mayor Walters was at our volunteer luncheon on Saturday, and I think she saw what a strong tradition of volunteerism we have at our library. We're very lucky to have the volunteers that we do have. They come to the library and they stay. We had one gentleman celebrate 25 years of volunteerism at the library. So we have over 2,100 volunteers. Fiscal year to date, they've given over 14,000 hours of service, and it's a cost savings in labor to the library of over $269,000 fiscal year to date. Okay, that concludes the presentation. Do we have any questions?
Okay. Questions on the library presentation?
Okay. Thank you.
And number three is her presentation to discuss fire department budget issues. Chief.
Morning, Mayor, members of the council, council members-elect. Another year of budget presentations. Here we go. I'd like to start just briefly by giving you a little background on the general services that the fire department provides. If you'll note the wheel that we've presented there, you can see that really our goal is customer service, and everything that we do focuses on good customer service. Obviously, in order to do that, there are certain programs we provide and a tremendous amount of support necessary to make that happen. And I clearly can't emphasize the amount of support necessary for that. You can't take for granted fire trucks going on EMS and fire calls just because they show up to work that day and get on the truck. There's a ton of work that goes on behind the scenes to make that happen. Moving on to just review our budget. As you can see, in fiscal year 06-07, the $60 million budget, the 478 positions, our actual was 53 million and 478 positions. One of the things that we know that goes on, you can see with the little asterisk at the bottom, the increase there reflects a 3% COLA, 5% benchmark, and over $7 million of carryovers, which basically involve purchasing of fire trucks that in our replacement program, as well as rebudgeted funds, which are grants, the things like that that are ongoing. And then adopted in 07-08 was 71 million, 478 positions, and the proposed budget for 08-09 is 64 million with 472 positions. And we'll talk more about the reductions here in just a moment. I'd like to note, though, that the fire department's gone through several reviews and audits over this past year. The city manager's office reviewed fire technical services, fire maintenance, and fire resource, and some of those, it's the second time in 3 years that they've been reviewed for efficiency. The council office has actually done an overtime, constant staffing overtime audit in the fire department, and we've had a federal audit of our weapons of mass destruction warehouse of the cache of equipment that we've purchased with grants. So we've been turned over and looked at several times this year, and I'm confident to say that we're a very efficient operation. I also like to note that really with the quality of life, we've been able to add some fire stations, but still we have not hired a firefighter with general fund dollars since 1998. And I don't believe that the purpose of the quality of life was to supplant general fund increases in the fire department's budget. And so as we'll go over more here in a minute, we're now 4 units short and 52 firefighters short currently just to maintain the service levels we had in 2004.
Question, Chief.
Just a quick question. The asterisk on the bottom, help me understand. I understand what the COLA is. What's the 5% benchmark? What does that mean? I understand the carryover, too.
The city of Mesa, I'm really not the best qualified, but I think I can give you a general description. The city of Mesa routinely reviews the market in terms of what the proper salaries will be for city employees in comparison with local communities.
Okay.
And they raise it to try to stay competitive. Is that close?
Like the police.
Exactly. It was, and that year is a result of a market survey to compare with other similar fire stations, fire departments.
The next slide gives you just a very brief, you've seen it before. It's a very brief explanation and shows kind of the staffing levels between the various fire departments. There's always going to be some discussion about what's included in those ratios, but that's the best of our ability. We updated it again this year. Eight of our units ran over 2,500 calls last year, and five of them ran over 3,000. The optimum performance for a fire company is about 2,500 calls a year. What that means is they're available for calls in their first two area over 50% of the time or a high percentage of their time, and that allows the response times to stay within 4 minutes most often. If they run more than that, then they're out of service and other units are having to cover for them, and obviously that's going to extend response times.
Chief,
also,
let me ask you a question on that. When I look at, and I picked either Chandler or Gilbert, but I picked Chandler because it's about half our size, they have 15,000 incidents. If we were to double that, they would be at 30, but we're at 53. So it looks like we are responding to a whole lot more incidences than other communities. What runs are we making that other communities are not?
Primarily, Mayor, we have the huge influx of winter visitors. I was just reviewing with Chief Stubbs a minute ago that for the month of March, clearly, by far, the busiest districts in our city are District 5 and 6.
So our EMS calls are through the roof compared to the other communities.
Exactly.
Does that also compare out to the demographics of the other communities then?
Well, I know our demographics are that we have the second highest population of elderly next to Sun City in the entire valley. And we have about the second highest children per capita in our community. And we consider both of those groups high-risk groups.
Okay. Mr. Truitt?
And I would assume that these winter visitors are not included in the city population.
That's correct.
Mr. Scott?
Just to clarify, Chief, the Mesa is not providing any additional services above and beyond what other departments provide. It's just that we are making more responses on the services the fire departments provide because of our demographics.
We simply have more calls per capita than the other cities do.
It's pretty substantially more.
Yes, it is, Mayor. And we see that growing. Clearly, it's also an indication of our inner city growing issue. We know that people with a struggle financially tend to need public service more often and more frequently. And we see that going up. And there's some other dynamics going on that I'll talk about later with some specifics, especially with two hospitals closing in the last year.
So when we have the open door mat for winter visitors, maybe we should say, but don't come here if you're going to be sick? How does that?
Unless you're from Canada and you have money.
I'm curious on cost recovery. Maybe that's not all factored in. I mean, they spend some sales tax, but if one or two calls for service, and boy, that's never going to get recouped.
There are a lot of mechanisms to recover those costs, Mayor, as you know.
Do you have the numbers for Phoenix?
I do not have them in front of me.
I would be very interested in that because really, you know, the comparatives here are, these communities are, and I use the word boutique community because a boutique describes a particular, you know, you're addressing a particular segment. And if you look at Tempe,
who just pointed out to me, Dave, did you?
If you look at Tempe versus Chandler, Tempe has more calls per service than Chandler, and yet Chandler has a higher population. And Dave said to me, students, and I don't know, you know, maybe that's it. It could be also the kind of thing that you're talking about. Chandler is a newer community. It may be a wealthier community. And when you have a full service community like Mesa, I'd like to see a comparison to a more full service community like Phoenix, a more full service community like Tucson. And I think the other one in the valley would be Glendale that would be more like us. So I'm concerned about just having the East Valley comparatives.
Vice Mayor, we have done some additional, in putting this information together, we actually did do some national research. And what you typically find, and really through my experience, it's very easy to see that the larger cities have a higher firefighter per capita than the smaller towns. And a lot of it just simply has to do with the inner city issues. And you can't, you know, again, you said it. The demographics are so unique in so many places that can account for so many swings in that, in those numbers.
I absolutely agree with you. I just think for us to look at the comparison, I think it would be helpful if we had those others, if we could get those.
We could. Yeah. Mayor and Council, and Councilman Truitt's question on population. I believe when the census is done, there is an accounting for winter visitors. They are given a, like, you take the estimate and then you use, like, it as a fraction of the total for the estimation. So
2/3 a person.
Is it?
But there is a formula that is used to try to account for that overall. You don't get one for one, but there is a fraction that's tried to be estimated. So, and Mayor and Council, as we go through this presentation, we're going to get into further discussion about response times and the impact about the difference between the west and east sides as we go into this presentation.
Thank you, Chris.
Oh, my gosh.
Let's move on here.
Yeah, please.
Before the competition gets any more intense. Just some basic education on why four-minute response times are so important. As you can see, our goal is to have arrive within 4 minutes 90% of the time. That's also a national goal. Very challenging goal, might admit, and probably no city in the country actually reaches that goal. So, but it is important, and the next slide describes why it is. In medical instances, especially those where you have no respiratory or no heartbeat, obviously the body begins to be starved from oxygen, and within 4 to 6 minutes, brain damage begins, and then you actually have biological brain death at 8 minutes. So if there's not an intervention started somewhere in that period of time, the survival rate is compromised significantly. In fires, we know from National Institute of Statistics that fire doubles in its size every 2 minutes, and that's with ordinary combustibles. That is not even talking about plastics and some of the petroleum products that are in combustibles now in homes. We know that flashover can occur in less than 8 minutes, depending on the nature of the fire itself. And what flashover is an immediate ignition of all of the flammable gases in the room, and essentially it sets everything else on fire when that occurs. And then obviously the survival rate for people stuck in a flashover condition is very low, if not zero. So you can see that if we don't arrive on the scene pretty quickly and begin to put water on the fire, we're looking at really very little opportunity to intervene in a life-threatening situation if someone was to be involved in that. Our first priority when we go to calls is not to put water on the fire. Our very highest and first priority is search and rescue. So you can see that we're completely aware of these statistics. Actually, these are physics. These aren't even really arguable at this point. The next slide gives you a little bit of a feel. We talked about it here the other day that at some point we need to put these years back to end to end so you get a little better feel of an annual trend. But at this point, this is a month-to-month chart. You can see that we have had fluctuations, but there is a trend here. In January of 06-07, engine 218 went in service at station 3. And you can see in January of 06-07, you can see a significant jump in our response time. We have other indicators in the system we'll talk about that shows a corresponding improvement of our response times for each unit that's added. And it's really rather significant. In May of 06 and 07, you can see a little anomaly there. We've had some research experts, statistical experts, look at that with us. We currently do not have a practical reason for that spike. We're told that if you put this out over several years, you may see several spikes in it on a month, especially on a month-to-month incremental basis. That might be a little more difficult to explain. But we do know that our dispatch protocols changed in 2007. We began to eliminate some calls that we used to run on emergency code 3 type calls. We worked in conjunction with the police department to, rather than send both police and fire to some of these incidents, we've narrowed it down to just one agency or the other. And examples would be that fire will no longer respond on threats of any nature, mostly like a threat of suicide or something of that nature. That would be a PD response. And PD will no longer run on respond for calls for emergency lockouts, either cars or homes, especially in the summertime if children are in car seats locked in a car and the keys are locked in. It's important that we go take care of that. In some cases, an elderly person may be in the home needing medication, and they need to get in right away to take care of that person. We'll go out and help them get in their house. Doesn't happen a lot, but that's just a general example of the kind of refinements that we've made to try to reduce the emergency calls that we go on. Next slide gives us a little bit of a trend. As you can see, our response times have actually increased 30 seconds over the last 3 years, and that includes adding Station 218, but you can certainly see the improvement in response times in 2007. This data is based on the calendar year, and basically what we draw from this kind of data is, for planning purposes, we expect that there's a trend. We've always been suspicious of this, and now we have, we think, some proof that there is going to be a continual degradation in our response times based on a lack of additional resources while there's a continuing either aging population or continuing growth in population. So we know that that's a factor. It's been hard to define up to this point. So for planning purposes, we're going to use 15 seconds increase for each year that no additional resources added. Given the growth in aging population, I'm sorry?
Good question.
Chief, in reference to your priority of calls and what type of calls you go on, I know you've been looking at this, but how do you think the false alarm, fire alarm impact impacts your calls for service and your response times? Have you got some numbers together? Are you in the process of doing that so that we know either an ordinance similar to the police false alarm ordinance could help us in some cost recovery? I know you can't prioritize not going or do the verification process that a burglar alarm would do, but I'm curious as to what you're looking at that may help in that area.
Yes, we have, in fact, we're in the process right now of looking at that and trying to deter or at least encourage people who have faulty alarms to have them repaired so we don't get false activations. But slightly more than 2,000 times a year, on percentage basis, that's fairly low. But 2,000 calls a year approaches a volume, a normal volume for a station. So it is significant. We are looking at trying to take some steps to reduce those numbers. And we think it should have some positive impact. Many of those types of calls we didn't necessarily run code 3 on, so they wouldn't really show up in some of this response time data.
But you have to do a move up, right? You still have to do a move up.
You still have to do the, and every time you do that, a secondary unit has to come in and cover that spot.
And then do you require any verification, on-site verification? Does dispatch call the site to verify prior to your dispatch, or are you rolling right away as soon as you get the call?
I believe we roll right away, but if you know, Brady, go ahead.
We do roll right away without question. However, we are looking at that, and there is some impact, and there is quite a bit of conversation that takes place between the responding unit and alarm, trying to alleviate the situation, find out if it's real or not at that time. But and we do plan to have more specific data based on that very question. So
thank you.
Mayor, Councilman Whalen, actually the Audit and Finance Committee, the Fire Department,
yes,
came forward and they were asked to go ahead and work on an ordinance similar to PD's. And I think that we actually talked about in that same context. Good. So we're hoping to bring back that back to the City Council here fairly quickly.
Now, the next slide gives you a little bit of a more specific breakdown of what happened in the area where our current Station 203 is. You can see that Engine 218, in the first full year of its service, ran 3,350 calls. Engine 203, during 2006, ran 4,200 calls. And so if you take a look at what happened there, it's kind of interesting because we put two engine companies running out of the same station, and they ran on over 6,500 calls. So in our business, that's sort of a black hole of service demand. I've seen it in other areas, in other cities as well. So it's the kind of thing where you have to begin to reinforce the surrounding areas with additional units that you can continue to put units in this spot here, and they'll probably continue to absorb those calls. So it's a challenge for us that we have a plan to try to deal with.
Chief, how many of those were over the border in Tempe of those calls out of that station?
I'm not sure in the exact amount of that. We did do an analysis a couple of years ago of our automatic aid and found that as cities go, on an annual basis, that 5% of the time Mesa ran and supported other communities in automatic aid, and 4% of the time other communities ran into Mesa and supported automatic aid. So the border stations are going to have a problem, and I know that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, well that one in particular, just because of its proximity.
I can find that data for you, but typically Station 3 doesn't run in there as much as some of other stations do.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit more about response times. As you know, one of the demographics of our city is that we have a very high concentration of population in the West City and a very rapidly growing population in the East Valley, but still the two issues that we have to deal with to manage response times is call volume, which, as we've talked about, interrupts our normal deployment system and causes a secondary unit to have to cover, extending response times. And the other dynamic is obviously the travel distance, which we experience in East Mesa. So those are the things that we have to balance, and the decisions about where stations are placed are based on a balance of those two key points. You can see, again, what I described, that in West Mesa, the population, high service demand, simultaneous incidents increase the response times. And in East Mesa, the growing population and the fewer stations, the longer travel times. Any questions on response times? That's pretty much it. Yes. There.
The calls that you roll on and the calls that... How do you determine whether it was a really viable, necessary call to roll on? Is there a way to do a better screening on when you disperse units? And because you try to arrive within 4 minutes to everything, I'm not sure that you need to. There are people that have, I've been sick all night and I got a terrible headache and I'm having trouble moving and whatever the issue might be, is not in the same order of, I got a chest pain, I just passed out or some other circumstances. So how do you determine that? Once you get a call, everyone gets treated the same, or do you have a prioritization mix? And I guess it's the same thing that Mike was alluding to on the false alarms.
Mayor, yes, we do. In fact, it's more intense now than it's ever been. As you may recall, we have a pilot program that we've been working on. We call the Transitional Response Vehicles. It's a two-person unit that only goes on low emergency medical calls and other service calls such as check alarms and those kinds of things. Our dispatch center works off of algorithms where they have a series of questions they ask each caller, and it's linear. It takes them to a point of what's the proper resource to send on that particular call. They also have the opportunity to exercise their judgment because of their experience, and in the event that they sense something different, they can always err on the side of safety. But we're working probably more on that than we have in many, many years, and I really do believe that your comment is right on point, because we're going to need to look at doing a better job of dissecting the types of calls we have and sending the appropriate type of unit rather than sending the full store to every call.
Yeah, I think the 2,000 false alarm, or 2,000 alarms for fires, how many of them were actually burning buildings?
Obviously, you wouldn't have that number, and I know that's not rhetorical, but it's a very low number.
It's about 2,400, I believe, but the actual number of incidents that right. came about was significantly low. The impact is not near what the police department deals with.
Because I thought the false, the alarms for police was like 95% were false, or it was some staggering number.
I think they respond to 16,000 as opposed to 2,000 for the fire department. It's somewhere in that vicinity.
Okay.
So but it's significant, Mayor.
I would suggest pursuing statistical and resource allocation. I mean, there's got to be some way that those things overlap at some point. Vice Mayor.
I agree. I think that and now I'm not talking about the false alarm aspect of things, but the triaging of calls. I was talking to some people in one of the senior communities, and you know, they were talking about the fact that due to various medical conditions, people fall down, and they haven't broken anything, but they can't get up, and they have an elderly spouse who can't help them to get up. Okay, now we send out, you know, our multi-million-dollar fire truck to help the person get up. The challenge is that sometimes there was an underlying medical problem there that really had to be addressed, and getting the person, you know, assessing them and saying, whoops, you have a real problem here, and you actually need to be to the hospital, as one woman said, she said, the Mesa Fire Department saved my husband's life. We thought he had just fallen. It turned out that there was something really wrong that had caused the fall. But so I don't know quite how to go about it, but sometimes somebody's just stuck or fallen or something, and you don't need the entire fire truck to go out there. One of the concerns I have, Chris, with cutting the TRV, and I know why we're doing it, but it feels to me like it's going the wrong way. It's almost, and take this, you know, everybody take a deep breath when I say this, it's almost like you should cut a fire truck and keep the TRV. I'm not saying we should cut a fire truck, okay? That's why I said everybody take a deep breath. But it is a cost that we're sending out there that we don't need to send out. And so I'm concerned, Chris, that we're, and I'm looking at you because I know that this was a pilot program that you had worked on with us.
And that is unfortunately some of the choices that you have to make in these circumstances, because what you'll see, I think we're going to talk about the TRV, and we really only had it budgeted for 2 years as a pilot program initially because we wanted to see how it worked. I've had experience using more instead of sending a pump or informed persons to emergencies like this, and it's been effective in other communities. And I think the department has embraced it, and what will show the statistics of its impact. I don't disagree, but faced with the other options, this really became the next best option within the current resources. I will tell you, however, we could double or even triple the number of TRVs that we've allocated. The end of the day is that's only a temporary stopgap measure to the issue. We are not keeping up with the growth and the demand in Mesa with its resources. So it's regardless of what we do, whether we take it out of the TRVs, whether we even hold the budget still and not do anything, as the chief has said, we're already five stations behind. I mean, part of the difficulty is that when we're responding, as to Councilman Whalen's point, we're having, as a unit goes and responds, especially on the west side, they're responding to a need. Now that means the deployment, the east side's equipment begins to move west to backfill, because that's where all the responses are coming. The majority of the preponderance of the weight of the number of calls is to the west side. The difficulty then, though, is that when there's an east side call, which are not as frequently as they are on the west side, but the distance traveled then is much more extended. So trying to balance out the protocols and kind of sorting through the level of emergencies and how we respond to them, you know, it's a very difficult situation, because we've had where we've even sent the TRV to incidences, calls that were initially determined to be of the lesser non-life-threatening nature, and most times I think they've been effective in being able to address those, but a lot of times, sometimes they'll get there and realize, no, there needs to be a transport, so then they have to call in the services. So it is a very difficult assignment of creating that balance without putting anybody's life at risk. So to suggest taking it from other resources as pumpers and ladder companies, the difficulty, if we're already saying we're four stations behind, that doesn't necessarily get us any further ahead. And we really didn't have we don't have right now any long-term resources even for the TRV. It is not a choice that anybody wants to make. It's just because of a budget decision we were forced to make.
I understand that. I'm just concerned that it's a false choice, a false economic choice, because when you have to then buy the pumper sooner, or the you understand what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying. The problem is that I would be in a position to, I think, feel more comfortable about that if we weren't so far behind.
Yeah, so if you had the underlying infrastructure in place that you need to
have. I would agree with you to that point, because your point, the logic is that on point.
Yeah.
But we're so far behind that I don't know that we get there with that.
My aunt and uncle live in an area that is not, it's a township. They're in Pennsylvania. They pay something like $100 a year, maybe it's $150 a year, to have the right to call for an emergency medical response team to come to their home. That's the additional amount of money. Yeah, the right to call. I mean, you know, sometimes, I don't know, maybe we need to look at some different economic models here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. I completely agree with you on your observations on the TRV. I know there's going to be a more appropriate time here in the presentation. Earlier, like 5 minutes earlier, a question: when we're looking at triage and the algorithms, an observation from old experience is when the call goes out for smoke and flames showing and it's a smoking outlet and we are rolling 5 or 6 units, code 3, screaming through the streets, maybe that's already been addressed. But I know maybe in the automatic aid realm of things, other departments may not share our more conservative view of how we roll and the tremendous resources on maybe not such a big deal. So I'm hoping that there'll be some opportunities to look at that, especially in the automatic aid perspective, to say if a community says, hey, we're going to go big, we're going to go fast, lots of units, and it may not reflect truly that emergency or that triage, a little smarter triage at it. I'm hoping we can go down that road, because I think that does have a tremendous, even if we're looking at 5% or 4%, some of those calls take a tremendous amount of resources, maybe across the border. And how soon are we breaking those loose to get them back? Are their philosophies really reflective of where we're trying to go in that? So just an observation.
Yeah, I think that Chris really was the best, explained it the best. We have the same challenges on the fire response side as we have on the EMS response side. That basically the dispatchers take the information based on the questions in the algorithm, and it produces a result. One of the things that we do not have here in Mesa is anybody with any firefighting experience in our dispatch center to help them exercise judgment in some of those situations. And we're pursuing right now what it would take to accomplish something like that. So you're absolutely right. I don't know that we're ever going to eliminate it, but I think your point is if we reduced it, we could have an impact on response times as well, and I think you're right.
Okay. Let's go. Okay.
The next slide was something that actually was a little bit interesting for us when we looked at it. And, you know, we think we know these things because we live with it every day. But when we produced this this map of incidents over 6 minutes in the city, we expected to see them all bundled on the west side, and then some obviously in the far east side. But what we see is a fairly consistent pattern, and I think again what it indicates is that every 6 minute response that you see here indicates a second due unit covering that call, and so it's uniform throughout the system. So we're saturated, as we said 2 years ago in this presentation. We are at a crossroads. We currently have, we can show direct corresponding increased response times with population growth and no additional resource. There's a direct correlation there now that we're going to be dealing with. There's no slack left in the system. Just to give you an example, this what you're looking at here is over 2,500 responses in 2007 that were over 6 minutes. So again, just another indication of sort of the condition of our emergency response system. We, as a fire department, as I mentioned going in, is we have very, you know, it's kind of like not having four tires on a car. If you don't have the three programs that Mesa Fire has for fire service, which includes fire prevention and public education, you really do not have a valid public safety program for fire and EMS. What we want to do now is I'm going to ask Chief Randy Leffler, who manages our community services division, which involves both code enforcement as well as public education, give you an explanation on these next two slides.
The first slide indicates the number of high, medium risk fire inspections that we're completing monthly. The graph is kind of backwards a little bit. The green is the most recent, and the red indicates the startup process for the inspection program that the council provided us the opportunity to develop. It has been developing. It started out a little bit slowly, but it is increasing exponentially to the point where we are expecting to maintain that more in the green throughout the life of this process. We've got inspectors that are much more qualified now than when they started, and they're beginning to go out on their own as opposed to being mentored by a more senior person. And as they get better at what they're doing, again, their numbers are going up each month. And it's showing that we're getting into more of the businesses than we ever have in my time at Mesa Fire. So.
Just to note, it was July of 07 that we added four additional inspectors. I think you can see an increase in productivity there. Even though they were novice and only could do a relatively low-level types of inspections. And then in November of 07, we added six additional to finally reach our full force. So the training has been ongoing for them, and I think you can begin to see as you go into 07, as you begin to look at January, February, and March there, that their expertise is kicking in, and we're beginning to accomplish the goals that we set for the program.
Ready, you might have a question, Daisy.
I noticed somewhere that there's some fire inspectors were getting cut as part of the budget. Is that right? Are we going to be able to maintain those numbers if we cut out inspectors?
We're going to do everything we can to meet those numbers.
How many are being reduced?
There's one inspector supervisor and five inspectors.
We're going to cover that in our presentation here.
Okay.
Very shortly in some detail. Again, as I mentioned, public education is crucial.
To speed this up, why don't we write down notes if you got questions so we can get through the presentation, because if in fact it's following, we'll get to it momentarily, okay. Hopefully. So, because we've got some time constraints here with some members too.
Okay.
Okay, the second one is the number of public education contacts by our FALS group, our fire and life safety group. Basically, that includes any educational contacts with the schools, with the elderly. They focus on those two because they're our high risk areas. It includes drowning prevention information that's provided to the public. It provides car seat information and or car seat installation. It is a fairly seasonal process, but that is picking up as we add more contacts to this. We have a very dedicated group that does a fine job in getting this information out to the public.
And as we review the budget reductions, you can see that we won't go over these individually, but obviously you can review those. And with Dan Stubbs as our operations assistant chief in charge of all of our emergency response programs, and I'll have him go ahead and explain the TRV program to you and the results we've seen in that program.
Okay, we've already talked about this a little bit, but I'll go through these as quickly as I can. Again, this is a pilot program that we received funding on for 2 years. We're in the first year finishing up. It's a two-person unit, again, to handle some of those non-life-threatening calls, some of those non-emergency service calls to relieve some of our four-person units. We placed them at Station 2 and Station 5. They've been in service, the first one at Station 2 since approximately August of this year. The one at Station 205 went into service in September. Just took us a while to get the second one up. We put them in those areas because, one, we have a high call density in that area. It also is surrounded by other City of Mesa property, so if it was going to respond out to pick up other calls, it would be staying in Mesa to do that. A few stats we have for you. Again, this is just a few months. This is from August and September, respectively, to end of March. So it's not a lot of data, but we're able to see some trends. One of the things we were hoping to see, that the availability of that primary engine where that unit was housed, the availability of that unit to be able to respond to a higher emergency. What you see there is a comparison for the same time frame, August to March of 2006 to March and August, August and March of 2007. For engine 202 in 2006, it was available for first due calls 57 percent of the time, which means 57 out of 100 calls, it went first. The remaining time, another secondary unit came in. Same time frame with the TRV was in service. It was available 65 out of 100 calls. So we did see an improvement of availability for engine 202. And respectively, you see down there for engine 205, it went from 63% to 72%. We found that pretty significant, pretty profound. We also had some dispatch protocol changes and other things that we put in place at that same time frame that we know helped impact that. The next slide you see is just a kind of a dot matrix of the two units and where they respond. The concentration, again, is heavily around the center point of the station where they're housed. But we just don't keep them there. We let them respond throughout the city to take those calls. An example, you may have a call up. You see some green dots over in Threes area. If the appropriate call type comes in for that fall person that seems like they have non-threatening injuries or something like that, the TRV will be dispatched there, or through the captain's communicating on engine 3 and the TRV, they will take the call. So that, in essence, frees up engine 203 to stay available for an ALS call and respectively around the rest of the city like that. And year to date, or the last several months we've had, they've responded to approximately 2,000 calls of service since we've had them in this short time. Next couple slides we have deal with some of the movement we have with our retirees and the drop program. We're able to bring some of these forward for this budget year, but as we go through there here, you'll see that this isn't a permanent reduction we're looking to bring forward. As the number of retirees go up in the next coming years, as we know they will, we've kind of had a high peak in year fiscal year 06 and 07 of around 30. This current year, we're projecting about 8 people to leave based on the drop program. And we expect in 2010, 2011, that to go up to 17. But based on the number that we have staying here and not retiring, we're able to use the succession planning money, or the money we use to replace the people that were leaving in the drop at this time. But again, that money is used to hire entry-level firefighters and is driven by the drop program. It allows us to send incumbents. As these firefighters are hired and trained, we need to send paramedics and people with technical rescue skills like hazardous materials technicians, technical rescue technicians. They go anywhere from a month for those technical rescue classes, anywhere from 6 months for the paramedic class. When they're gone, we need to put somebody in their seat. Previously, we've hired back people at time and a half money. It was more cost effective for us if we have a lot of known vacancies to bring somebody on, pay them at regular pay, put them in the seat when they're gone. The theory is when that person comes back from their training, that other person retires, and it's just a match. We're able to keep somebody in the seat at all times. And again, because we have less people leaving this coming year with retirements, and we're able to bring this forward. Another area that we're looking at is the minimum staffing. This is basically some of our overtime funding we have for vacancies that we have. We've put this amount, $183,000, to kind of balance out the amount that we needed to bring forward. We use this money to maintain constant staffing levels due to department leaves and department commitments. We may have sicker injuries beyond what was expected or beyond the normal vacation leaves. We use our minimum staffing money to backfill those positions. We have other commitments due to training classes and or their commitments to other departments that we might loan somebody to. As an example, when we do our firefighter recruit testing and our promotional exams, we borrow members from other departments to come in. Likewise, when they do their testing, we may send somebody over a few times a year to do testing for them. This money is used for that. It's also a commitment to our personal safety and efficiency of an emergency scene. We've given you several examples that on a lot of our emergencies, we need a certain amount of people to do the task. If you've got a motor vehicle accident with a lot of extrication needs, or you have a structure fire, you need a certain amount of people to do the task. Otherwise, it's a delay in getting the task done. So that's another reason why we constant staff back. It will require us with this cut to have some restrictions on some of those classes, some of those times that we've allowed people to be off for certain things, some of their shorter times. We probably won't backfill for some of those. And it may require us to send more units to calls. Again, as I explained earlier, we have a certain amount of personnel we need on a scene. If we don't backfill the company for a 4 to 6 hour time period and we leave them at 3 and they get a fire or another big motor vehicle accident, they may call for another company just to balance out the additional manpower that they might need. So those are some of the restrictions we're facing. The third thing that's kind of tied to the attrition is the recruit academy. We had been budgeted for 2 recruit academies of 10. Again, based on the number of people that we know are leaving based on the projection of the drop, we're able to drop that down to 1 academy for this next coming year. That should keep us pretty much just right even. We are going to be vacant with a couple positions for a short period of time that we'll have to backfill those positions with that overtime money. But reason we can bring forward this at time is we're not replacing the number of firefighters due to the drop. It may require additional overtime costs to fill some of those vacancies that I talked about. And it also revert back to reactive hiring based on attrition rather than a proactive hiring. And again, we see this as a temporary reduction because, again, as those numbers go up, we will need those dollars put back in our budget to maintain the staffing levels that we have.
The next slide is for fire prevention code enforcement, and Chief Leffler will give us a brief presentation on that.
The slide on the screen now is basically highlights of the program that's been asked about previously for the code enforcement and cost recovery program. The proposed reduction of $394,000 equates to 6 positions, 5 inspectors and 1 inspector supervisor. As I alluded to earlier, the program has had a fairly slow startup, but it is fully rolling now. Some of the things that we've done, we've inspected approximately 60% of the high and medium risk occupancies, which is approximately double what we did last year. And that number will continue to go up as our inspectors become more comfortable with their new positions. We've identified over 14,000 life safety hazards, and those range anywhere from chained off exits, locked exits, inoperable fire extinguishing systems to wall plates missing. Those were identified. We expected a high number of those initially. We expect in the next year and the year after that those to go down because some of these businesses haven't been inspected for some time, and so we're making quite a bit of headway in that area. We've identified approximately 70 structures with inappropriate building and zoning permits, and we have partnered with the Building Safety Group to try and kind of tag team these. As we find these, we identify those for the people that would be most appropriate to go out and re-inspect that and cite and do the research necessary to make sure that they did not fulfill their obligation with respect to building and zoning permits. Yeah. Again, the reduction in the number of position is to maintain the cost recovery goal that we've decided to use.
Tom?
Are these 6 positions vacant?
3 were vacant and 3 were occupied. Okay.
I guess I'm trying to understand. I thought we had a sort of a plan that it was going to be a full cost recovery. We were going to be able to afford the number of people necessary to do the inspections because we were going to be getting the money from the community to do it. What's not happening or is happening?
That's exactly what we're doing, Mayor Councilman Rawls, is that we are adjusting now, having now had the experience and actually knowing the number of accounts that need to be inspected, we're able to now make the adjustment to ensure we're doing full cost recovery. If we had these 6 positions in there funded for next year, our concern is that we would not be at full cost recovery. Our expenses would be greater than the revenues that would be.
So we're finding that we can do, I guess what I'm trying to say, I think we set up, again, the goal was to hit every high risk every year and then the medium risk every other year.
Right.
Are we going to be able to fulfill that goal with the number of people that you have in the program now? I mean, with these cuts going forward, are we going to reach that goal?
We have every intentions of working towards that goal and are somewhat optimistic that we can do that. Okay. It won't be without some difficulties based on less number of people.
But it's essentially, you've been at it a while, you understand now what it involves a little bit more, you've got a better handle on the numbers, you're coming back, and rather than just keeping the people that might push you over way over full cost recovery and might not be necessary to perform
correct
the task, so we're not cutting back on the program, we're more efficiently performing or servicing the program, hopefully.
Well, and realign the resources
right
to the cost,
okay,
while trying to achieve the objectives of the
right
program.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate the intent. You can't sit here today and guarantee us that you're going to go to every place, but the intent's there, that's the goal, that's the purpose. Resources are being scaled back because you don't think you need them all. I just didn't want it to be this is a low-hanging fruit, so we're going to cut the we're going to cut the program. We're not cutting the program. We're hopefully doing it at a full cost recovery level.
That's correct. We've dissected every aspect of this.
Right.
This.
Yes. No, I appreciate that. We probably spent more time on this issue getting that program in place in terms of how many and stuff. And I just didn't want us to just because we're crimped going in and saying and destroy the program. So terrific.
Councilmember Rawls, we'll be monitoring that very closely. And as we attempt to meet the goals you just described to the program, we may add or reduce the staffing as necessary. So very briefly, just to cover some current issues, future issues, we've talked a lot about them already, so I'll be brief as I can. In essence, in summary, essentially, we are way behind, and I think we've talked about that at some length already. Just as for note, we did have an ISO, which is an Insurance Services Offices organization, which rates fire departments and basically fire service systems in cities to set insurance rates. We were due, it was 10 years ago that we had our last rating. We were due this year to have the next, in 2006, and the city of Mesa went from a class 2 to a class 3 department. Most departments in the valley are at least a class 2, and so we have had a significant hit there. To maintain the class 2 rating, we would have needed to have 4 additional stations and 4 additional units. With that, each station requires 13 firefighters, which is a total of 52 positions we are currently short if we were to maintain the rating that we had 10 years ago. Based on the growing service demand and the response time trends, we need to be adding at least one unit every year to meet our current service level. That's not to improve service level, that's to maintain the service level we currently have. Based on this formula, if the bond program was to be approved by council and the citizens were to vote in favor of it, we would not see our first fire station built until fiscal year 10-11. I shouldn't say built. It would not be staffed until fiscal year 10-11. It wouldn't be functional until that year. There's 3 years in that bond cycle where we will not have the ability to add firefighters in any form because the dollars simply aren't there to provide the O&M to open fire stations. And it's not so much about the bonds. It has more to do with hiring the people, as you all well know. But including the new unit in 10-11, we will be 104 positions short at that time to maintain our current service levels. In the EMS area, I really can't emphasize enough the unbelievable surge in demand for services in EMS that we're about to experience here, not only in the city of Mesa, but as a nation. The baby boom population, the first baby boomers reached 62 this year, are beginning to draw Social Security. And the rate at which baby boomers will retire is alarming. If you take a look at that, we know that elderly is a target, is a high hazard group. We kind of kid ourselves, say people used to just have one heart attack and we didn't have that customer was no longer going to call us back. Nowadays it's 2 and 3 times because medicine is so good. So the recidivism, if you will, is going to be much higher than it's been in the past. I don't mean to make light of that subject, but I think you get my point. To add to that, here on the west side, we have 2 hospitals that have closed recently. And that's created a very serious condition for us here on the west side. We're obviously going to have longer transport times for any patient that needs to be transported to a hospital from anywhere in the west side here, especially the northwest side. In 2007, there were 2,238 transports to to Banner Mesa, and 3,314 transports to Mesa General, and that doesn't account for the walk-up emergency room visits. And if people don't have transportation, the likelihood of them dialing 911 and creating the need for us to respond, whether it's real or not, what they describe is what we have to respond to. We're going to see our call volumes go up significantly just because of the closures of those hospitals. And in addition to the EMS service demand, I think many of you know that we are really deficient in terms of the level of equipment that we should be employing in our EMS, and more specifically is the 12-lead EKG monitors. We should have done that a couple of years ago, but obviously under the budget constraints, we weren't able to do that. We are at a point now where the life cycle is expiring for the units that we currently have, and we will have to replace them with something in the next couple of years. And it only makes sense that we should go to the next model that basically everybody in the country is using. Makes sense. If just to the next page gives you some basic information about our emergency medical, again, I can't overemphasize what's going on there. We treated over 38,000 patients in 2007. We had 296 full codes. What that means is people that were not breathing and had no heart, had no pulse. And the cardiac-related items there were 532. I might add that many of those, if you look at the next item, we talk about trauma transports, trauma patients, 2,500 trauma patients last year that needed a level one trauma facility. The East Valley, including Tempe and Chandler, does not have a level one trauma facility. And there are well over a million people living in this side of the valley, and there's no trauma center. Trauma centers have to be put in by hospitals who want to do it. There has to be a profit reason for them to do that. So in the meantime, we're transporting people to the closest trauma centers, which is Scottsdale Osborne and Maricopa Medical Center. Many times what that means is that we will have to fly our patients via helicopter. There's almost nothing more dangerous in what we do than fly helicopters with patients across the city. It's one of the most dangerous things that we do, to try to land a helicopter in a neighborhood or in an intersection, because we have someone with trauma injuries that are going to require significant surgeries that the local hospitals here in the East Valley simply can't handle. And that's happening more and more often, and as the freeway opens this summer around the east side, we're going to see more and more high-speed accidents with increased traumas. It's really an unacceptable condition right now. With not having that level one trauma facility in East Valley, it's really unacceptable.
Yes, ma'am.
Chief, that's, you know, as you pointed out, that's a decision that's made by hospitals. But given the size of our community, if there were a level one trauma center located in, let's say, at Banner Desert Medical Center, and you had an accident that occurred at, you know, on the Super Red Tan, wouldn't you still need to air evac them? Because, I mean, the distance between there and Dobson and the 60 is no different really than the distance between my house and Osborne.
Vice Mayor, I understand your question, and there would be times that once you get them in the air, it's only a matter of a couple of minutes. But with the completion of the freeways and with Desert being right on the freeway, my guess is that we would ground transport that patient. It's much safer. Generally, you can do it much quicker. If you've ever witnessed it, you stabilize a patient, a trauma patient, the best that you can, and then you have to package them for air transport, which is another step in the process that requires them to be set up in such a way that the nurses and the paramedics on the helicopter have access to the patient and are able to treat the patient en route. That's part of the decision process that the fire captains make on the scene of those incidents. They weigh all those issues and say, the bottom line is, I've got to get them to a trauma center, even at the cost of more time to load them and get them transported. So it's a very difficult decision, and it's one that won't go away even if we had a trauma center, you're correct. But clearly, travel times, everything's distance. So it all plays into the equation. If I can move quickly, very quickly, just to talk about the bond items that we have before you. I won't go through those. I do want to make one little correction for you in it. The first item on slide 25, where it says construction of four new and one replacement station or two replacement stations should be a one replacement station, because the second item on the list is a joint police fire facility that would replace a fire station, and I didn't want in there twice. Did it?
It did get corrected.
Oh, good. I didn't know that it made it through the cut. Obviously, the key issues for us in the bond program are going to be adding fire stations. But as I mentioned when I started out, you really can't deliver the service that we're trying to deliver without the support systems behind it. And that requires dispatch capabilities, communication capabilities, training capabilities and facilities, and all of the things that go along with that. The other side of the equation, that I can demonstrate for you statistically and with data what's happening to our response system because we don't have resources. It's very difficult to describe that in terms of what's happening on the support side of the equation. But I can tell you that you begin to hollow out the infrastructure, and things, you begin to see more and more mistakes, start to have more and more problems, and it just begins to compound. And it's symptomatic of really not being funded the way we need to fund the fire department for a city of this size. The last map, and in closing, is our 4-minute response time map. Again, it's generated by computer based on the probability that we would respond in 4 minutes within the areas of green. The blue areas are where we currently plan to locate fire stations if the bond was approved. And I don't know if I can refer you back to the 6-minute or more slide within the packet, but I think you can see in the far east side, in the area east of the proving ground, that we have a real surge in service demand in that area that's going unmet, and we do have a station now planned for that area. So that concludes our presentation. Okay. Any further questions?
Real quick, Chief, and this is a temporary measure only, just a thought process. Do you think one of the local ambulance companies would be willing to assist us in a TRV program based on an RFP, that they could run a temporary program since they're in there for the money? Maybe they could get some reimbursement, because if an private ambulance comes to your house, they get paid. Is there some way that we could look at that possibility of temporarily having them take that project on until we can get this community to properly fund public safety?
There are some experiments going on around the valley and really around the country with regard to that. In the state of Arizona, the ambulance companies are only licensed to transport. So anything other than a transport, they are not able to charge for. So there's really no cost recovery. So it would be at our cost.
Be at our cost, but then once they got there, if they then did transport, they could have some cost recovery.
That's correct. And they're right now, they're transporting all of our patients now, so I don't know that they would gain much in that transaction.
But would they be perhaps cheaper than we could do it and have a larger base to pull from to maybe operate 4 or 5 facilities around the community out of vacant buildings, perhaps? You know, that we got enough of them out there in shopping centers and whatever. I know it's a funky stopgap, but I don't see this community stepping forward to fund these things, even if they do today for 2011. And that's what concerns me as to how are we going to, you know, we can talk and talk and talk, but nobody seems to be listening.
Well, Councilmember Whalen, I'll be short and blunt. If there was a profit to be made, the ambulance companies would be in it. That's what they do. There's currently some issues going on right now within DHS, who regulates what ambulances can and cannot do and what they can and cannot charge for. And the ambulance companies are actually actively involved in trying to reduce the possibility of the options that you're just describing. Now, having said all that, and I didn't mention it earlier, but we did do a 60-day pilot using physician's assistants during this flu season to try to keep people out of the emergency rooms, and again, keep our companies in service longer to improve response times. We're doing things every day to try to work towards that. There is a possibility that a physician's assistant could charge insurance companies, or if people were qualified for Medicare or Medicaid, they could essentially charge them for that. So the doctors group we worked with are looking into the possibility of that, and that could defray some costs in the future. There's a lot of stakeholders involved in that process, and we have a lot of work to do, but we're pursuing that very avenue to figure out other methods to reduce costs and still improve, not even improve, but maintain a good quality level of service.
Chief, the councilman brings up a good point. Could we charge for the temporary response service?
Right now, there's not a mechanism for that.
Is it by city or state law? I mean, could this council approve a fee related? I mean, we're not calling Southwest Ambulance, but we are providing an assistance when we get there. I mean, is that a possibility?
I'm not sure.
Mick, should we look at that? That just kind of...
I think anything needs to be on the table right now, because this is a doomsday scenario that we've been presented with. And I don't know if people understand that. We got the same doomsday scenario from the police department. And we sit here and we go, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? Because we can't do anything until the people in this community step forward and realize the seriousness.
It's fraught with challenges. One is that most ambulance companies only recover about 60% of their collectibles. What do you do with the people who can't afford to pay? Do you go or not? I mean, you got to go. I think you need to go. It really comes down to a decision about whether it's the role of government to provide emergency medical services. And if so, then we have a responsibility to do that. And I think we need to have an obligation to do it in the most efficient way we possibly can. But I think you're aware of the difficulties that could go into that.
Alex?
I'm going to try to use as much diplomacy as I can in this, and I share the passion what's going on. This is unacceptable. It's unacceptable in this community to approach this problem like this. Chris, as city manager, I'm telling you, I was hired on a public safety platform allowing this public, and I'm using PD too. I didn't have the chance to really vent on the PD side because all the drama that was going on, so I just let it go as my first day, but excuse me. There is something we can do, is we can find you 4 votes. We can ask the city manager to use whatever means necessary to get the funding you need to get this done. The specific 2 items on the budget proposed that you've done today, minimum staffing cuts is unacceptable, if you ask me. And if you need a Wellington tragedy institutional knowledge update, I'll gladly give that to you. There was a reason why there's minimum staffing. TRV cuts, one of the rare times that you see innovation coming out of the fire service, it makes no sense at all that we would go and cut that program. You're right, it's just a minimum portion of a really big problem. You guys have been, and PD too, public safety has been running so lean for so long in this community, it's a train wreck. So what I would hope to see, and I hope I can get 4 votes either, you know, as we go through this process, you should be back here offering us an emergency clause or emergency plan to immediately address response times and some of these other issues, the 12 lead, as soon as possible. 2010, 2011 isn't going to do it. It isn't going to do it for another year. What makes me crazy in this process, and as I'm fighting out there, people think I was opposed to the bond issue. The bond issue doesn't fix the basic problems in this system that we're using. And so I'm hoping, I can look to new council members, I'm hoping I'm not trying to make this too much of a drama. This whole thing with police and fire, and even in some of the code enforcement areas, it's unacceptable. We have got to come back with another plan and fix how we're doing this right away. Not let this linger, let this be a political ball that fits into the bond issue, but get something done. We need to get it now.
Sorry, Mayor.
The council's had discussions in the past, and one of the challenges that I've always put out is if you have a program to step up the public safety and it costs 10 or 15 million, tell me where the money is coming from. Because to only present one side, if I want additional programs or this is unacceptable, is one component to that. And obviously, you understand the other is, and we shut down the libraries, we shut down the parks in order to do so, or we put in a bond package that has enough money in it, or whatever the other side of that equation is. So I request that that also be thought out.
Permission to respond?
Please.
Thank you, sir. And I appreciate being up here and being a part of this.
Mm-hmm.
you guys need to get four votes and fix this secondary property tax issue. I'm calling you out right now in front of everybody. You need to fix this. Don't stick the new council with this burden. Fix it now. I realize all the arguments. Get it fixed before we go into this, free up that $25 million a year, and let us progress with whatever the ramifications, the ways will be. Let us be able to get something done and get it done right.
Okay. And I would put out the challenge to the new council that if they need another $100 million or $200 million in a bond election, then you have 30 days in which to call that election and put it in. So think it through.
And I hope I haven't offended you, Mayor. No, the political, this has been going on for years. It's been going on since 1988. You know, to put that burden politically on us when it's been your babies for so long, you need to take care of it now before you hand it to us.
Well, I'm afraid that this council's already discussed it. It's going to be handed over, and you've got 30 days to either change it or live with what's been presented is the way it's going. So I think it has been well thought out and what we thought community would support, and that's why it was put in the way it was. Vice Mayor?
I think the challenge, Alex, is that if we went about it that way, I don't know how you pass your bond election in November. I think you have an issue of integrity, of people being able to feel like they can trust what councils have told them, and that's why we've had the conversation. People talk about it as political courage. It isn't about political courage. It's about, in my mind, it's about integrity. It's about the voters feeling that they can trust what the council says. And therefore, without putting it to a vote that says there will be secondary property tax attached to this, I think you have a problem. And I think the problem is you might solve this short-term issue and you never again pass a bond because people don't believe you or they don't believe the council. And this truly is a matter of on the job, on the problem. Because the day you get elected, from that day on, you're a politician. You're no longer that neighborhood activist, that person who cared. You are the problem now. And so, you know, it would be an easy thing. I mean, we're walking out the door. There are five of us walking out the door. We just put it on, and we vote it, and we say, and, you know, we give them cover. We say, Scott, Kyle, yeah, you vote no. Go ahead. And we give them cover, and we walk out the door. But I think that you're left with a problem that's so much bigger that I don't know how you deal with it.
And we're not talking about the increase I missed to begin with. This is the $25 million is what we could eliminate if we did the secondary property tax, which we have the ability to do. Okay. And I would say that, you know, one of the options, obviously, if the bonds fail, the council will have no option but to probably do that if they want to do it. So it forces the issue by the very vote of the public. So it'll be an interesting time, and I appreciate the input.
A quick question.
Dave.
The fire bond projects, a quick question about the construction of the four new and replacement fire station. Does that number include the construction of the station and all the apparatus that goes in it?
That's correct.
The trucks, yeah. The all the equipment.
Okay. Yes.
Everything fully loaded up.
Thank you.
Okay, Mike?
Along those lines, could we temporarily move into affordable structures while these things are being built, too, if that bond election passes?
We have, obviously, that's a strategy used in a lot of communities. We've looked into that, and although there may be some places that it would be more cost-effective than others, in general, what we find is the infrastructure requirements that need to be brought in are in excess of $1 million in some cases, and our decision has been that it's, if we can get it and do it right the first time, we're probably being more efficient with the dollars.
You're looking at
so that's a discussion
probably a year on the equipment manufacture and purchase also.
And don't forget, we have to have the people. And I,
oh,
think
I understand the people
factor
are a totally different question.
Yeah. Councilman, the chief and I have talked about this because I have used temporary stations and other situations for anticipating a new. But that's when we had a five-year program. We knew that there was going to be a station there eventually. It may be related to the fact of just getting land availability or those funds available, getting the funds available. But the chief's right. We have to balance that out with how much cost do you sink into a temporary that you don't necessarily benefit to the ultimate final station. And so, again, it's an evaluation that we can do. Communities do use that as an opportunity to try to accelerate programs in place. But I will tell you, it's also communities that can go ahead and fund the staffing to be there. The staffing is not the issue. It's just getting the facility. Our challenge, frankly, is bonds give us facilities, but they don't give us the people. And so we're still stuck with that issue.
Okay, Mr. Stewart.
Two or three questions here. I went back to your emergency medical chart, and I just noted that about a third of your calls are for seniors over 65, and I'm just trying to help you make your point. Surely seniors over 65 are not a third of the city of Mesa's population. So I think you're just trying to make that point that as the aging population goes, these calls are going to go up and up and up.
Exactly. Thank you.
Second thing was fire impact fees. We have fire impact fees, don't we, with new development?
Correct. For new facilities, that's correct.
And part of your projections or things are all growth related. I'm just wondering if we shouldn't revisit what those fees should be.
And we can't, Mayor and Councilman Truitt, as we've gone through the exercise with the council, by state law, we are restricted that we can only, and Chuck will have to help me out, we can only impose that based on the current level of services. And so when you get further behind, your current level of services aren't necessarily equal to what it costs to do new.
I appreciate that, but we're hearing all these predictions that our level of services are going to continue to go down.
And I don't disagree. If we could impose a higher level of that impact fee for fire service, we most likely would. But we are restricted by very strict statutes, and we actually have a consultant that's brought in who has to go through all that review.
I'm just questioning whether or not it's time to do that again.
Oh, we just did it
last year,
and we're indexing those. Part of the indexing, too?
Yes, that's part of the indexing.
So they are being indexed now to the cost of construction.
So define for me the term current.
But I'm sorry, the
current level of service?
As it exists today.
Well,
by state law, you have a nexus defined by what we're currently providing to the population.
What's the benchmark? 2005, 2006, 2000?
Oh. No, it's based on our current asset of inventory of fire-related services. So that's all you can...
It's going down every year, and then
Well, that's our problem, because we don't keep adding to it. Our formula gets... We get hit twice.
So current degrades. Every time you go and look at it, current is degraded.
Exactly. So
that's
if we don't keep... Yeah.
Okay, no, I'm getting the picture. And then the last thing I worry about is that a lot of these budget cuts are not sustainable. A lot of these budget cuts that they're proposing are because we're having fewer retirees in this year, which are going to go back up next year. So this isn't a sustainable model even in itself.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So I think I'm on board. I've heard lots of venting. I think I'm on board with the concept of, is there something, I guess I'm going to challenge people to think a bit outside the box. And I don't know what that is, but I'm as frustrated as everybody else at the table.
Okay. Well, an interesting discussion, and I think we had it months ago when we worked on the bond package, and I know...
See, I came at the end of the bond package, okay. So I didn't get to play with that part of it.
Councilmember Rawls pointed it out, and it's the $25 million. If that debt service wasn't there, you're in pretty good shape. I mean, it certainly helps a lot, but... Then, as the Vice Mayor mentioned, that was a kind of a promise that secondary property tax would not be implemented, unless there was some type of a voter approval of the citizens, that we would do it without the necessary of implementing that, that we had the revenues when it was those issues were put out there. So it's a fundamental question that would be fun to go through and do another discussion. I'm certainly willing to entertain that if we want to give it a try, but I think my reaction is that it's going to upset any other type of bond elections in the future.
And Mayor,
for a period of time, and then you're going to get $25 million, but you're going to lose the ability of bringing in, that pays off 200 or 280, and then you got $400 million you want to move forward that may be killed. So, which one do you want to go with? But great discussion.
Thanks.
All right, Tom.
Mayor, I'm willing to have that discussion in at the May study sessions when we get through with the individual department presentations, when everything is on the table, and I think it needs to be part of the discussion.
Good time for it.
But I will also say to my new colleague that the responsibility doesn't end when this council leaves office. If it's something that you want to do, you can do it just as well as me. I appreciate the challenge. And I've, for 4 years, I've tried to shift money to public safety from other areas of the city's budget and haven't been successful. So maybe this is another thing we need to think about for the last time, and I'm willing to have it. But I want to point out that the opportunity, because we, quite frankly, are not going to vote on the budget. You know, the opportunity doesn't end with us. So the responsibility is just as much yours as it is ours.
I'm not going to repeat the term that was used over here, but the to your issue, one of the areas that I think we need to look at, and I believe the fire department is, in District 6, particularly with regard to Mesa Proving Grounds, is having the developer start funding the infrastructure or maybe providing a couple years of operating costs as well. I know it's been done in Buckeye, a few other cities, and when you have a very large master plan community develop out, is an opportunity to set up a new funding mechanism that doesn't rely on the old.
Developers will
fight it.
No. What they will say is, I'll do this fire improvement or this police department improvement for credits against my future impact fees that I will incur as I develop. And you will get them to be a bridge, but you won't double dip them. You won't say do this and then pay those impact fees.
And we have to find that balance and strike that balance. But obviously
they do it all the time in the water and sewer and everything else. They'll build all kinds of water and sewer infrastructure and then have credits against the impact fees that they would have paid later. And that's a good thing. I mean, we could look at that as a bridging mechanism, just like we do in the other infrastructure needs.
Right. Any other questions fire related? All right.
Another quick question on the bond. I noticed that there's, and I just think it needs to be clarified for the public's sake too, is you have construction of four new fire stations, and then down below it says acquire land for four future stations. I'm assuming that land isn't for the four new fire stations. It's for additional as we grow.
That's correct. Okay. However, some of the stations that are in the bond program, we do not own the property for yet. And the cost for that property is included in the bond request.
Oh, of the $25
million? Yes.
That
yes.
includes land and fully built dock station?
In two cases.
There's some that we do own the property and some that we don't.
Right.
Okay. All right.
I want to be clear on that.
Perfect. Thank you.
So I'm sure you've had this discussion, but it seems like the thing that is partially handcuffing us is this state law that says that you can't impose impact fees to do anything but sustain a declining level of service. So legislatively, have we tried to say, well, that's not a very good law?
Mayor, Councilman Truitt, we are doing every day, we are down there probably today, just trying trying to maintain what we're getting now. We're actually being threatened more with losing ground than anything that we could do to go forward.
I understand
forward.
We have a legislature that
doesn't
support the realities of city government.
It's the home builders.
But this council, when we had our last report, went to look at replacement value.
That
so
is
we
right.
didn't substantially.
We evaluated
we
made
it. It used to be on what it was valued at plus divided by population.
Right.
We upped it to replacement value, not current.
But we are trying to address it at that level, yeah.
I think we all realize here that we have a model that cannot be sustained.
That's
so the question is thinking outside the box and what can we do and where do we do it? And maybe we need to – I don't know what the answers are. I know I'm beginning to better understand the problems.
Vice Mayor.
I think part of the answer is that people need to understand that they get what they pay for. And until we get to that fundamental understanding – for the residents of the community, a core belief that you get what you pay for, not what your neighbors come into the community and shop for and you hope you're going to get, But the level of service that the residents of Mesa are getting is the level of service that they're paying for. And we all would like to believe that the problem is that somehow we aren't efficient enough. We'd all like to come in and say, well, if we could just tweak this or take that out or whatever. But at some core level, things cost money, and they're costing more money. When those fire trucks go out, they're running out on fuel that is now, you know, we're approaching $4 a gallon in this country for fuel. Does anybody really think that the problem there is that our fire trucks, you know, shouldn't go out? That's what's causing the problem? I don't think so. So really, you know, bottom line, core discussion should be, in our community, is this the level of service you want? Or when you pick up the phone and you dial 911, do you want to have somebody come and respond? And what kind of response do you want? And that's what has to take place. The community wasn't ready for that discussion previously. Maybe they'll be ready for the discussion soon, I hope. Because I really think that we have gotten used to in Mesa having a free lunch. People in Chandler shopped here, people in Gilbert shopped here, and we were able to dine on their dollars, and that just isn't true anymore. And it really gets to be painful when you're having to actually pay the price for your own things. And I think that's the bottom line. We can look at thinking outside the box. By the way, guys, I hate that phrase, but we can look at. That's why I went like this. We can look at innovative ways of doing things. I tell people that I think one of the good things that's happened to Mesa is that we've had financial challenges because we have looked at different ways of doing things. Look at what's happened with the library, with the RFID system, you know, automatic checking of books, people checking out their own books. Those aren't bad things, but you reach a point where you're talking about core services and how much it costs for core services. And the mayor's comment, you know, well, where's the money going to come from? You can close the libraries. Well, I hope not. I don't want to live in a community that doesn't have libraries. I don't want to live in a community that has nothing besides police and fire. And so, yes, Tom, I would agree that you have tried to transfer some of those, and some of them I have agreed with them, but most of them not, because I like the community I moved into. What I didn't know when I moved in here was that somebody else was helping to pay for it. I wasn't paying for it all myself.
Councilmember Jones.
Again, thinking on the prospects of where do you get the money to change the formula in order to get to be able to beat that formula to say we have to increase our service level. And you know, we have decided, okay, we're going to have a certain amount of reserves, which improves our bonding capability. And you can have that discussion, okay, do you reduce that reserve to offset, to build the service so that you can increase the impact fees? And those are the kind of things we're going to have to determine, and that's going to come down the line, and the new council is going to have to take a good hard look at, because we have a set amount of dollars that we have in revenue, and divvying it up is a very challenging thing. So if we want to be able to increase those impact fees, we have to raise our level of service, and you got to get that money from somewhere. So we got to look at those trade-offs of what it's going to be. Do we take money out of those reserves, reduce the reserves that we have, so that then it increases our cost of bonding? So it's a gamble all the way around, but there are things that are going to have to be put on the table.
Councilmember Whalen.
Never mind.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. I am suggesting that item number 4 be rescheduled. All right. Number 5, acknowledging receipt of minutes of boards and committees. We have 3. Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Meetings and or conferences? Pass on that one. Scheduling meetings and general information.
Just a reminder, City Hall in the Mall, this Saturday, April 12th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Fiesta Mall. And our next study session is April 17th, which will be followed by a Transportation Infrastructure Committee meeting.
Thank you. Items from citizens present.
Mayor, received a card from Dilworth Brinton Jr. who wanted to speak on it relative to agenda item 2, the library budget.
Good morning, or maybe I should say good afternoon. I am Dilworth Brinton Jr. Some of you already know me as a longtime volunteer in Mesa, person born here, pioneer stock. Currently, you have appointed me to serve on the Library Advisory Board. As an advisory board member, we do not make decisions. We rather make recommendations, advice, and give input to city departments that we work with to help them make better decisions. the savings that we hope benefit both the citizens and the governance of our community. At our January meeting, we were told that the library needed to cut its budget. That time, we were also told that we would be allowed to help with this decision by giving recommendations and advice. When we met in March, we were told that city management had forbidden the librarian and the staff to talk with us about any of these problems. As her advisory board, the librarian was not to take any recommendations, input, advice, or suggestions. She was to give us no information about the pending problems or the solutions that faced the library and its budget. Apparently, a siege mentality has set in. City management does not want recommendations, input, or advice from the citizens. Management does not trust us, nor do they want our help. The members of the library board were extremely unhappy about this, and we expressed our displeasure with this, only to have it excised from the minutes of our meeting, which we have then since restored. As a board member, we met with the librarian and the staff 10 days ago. At this time, Heather and her staff were allowed to talk with us. In detail, they explained the budgetary problem facing the library. They explained the reasoning and their rationale in arriving at the budget cuts that they felt were necessary. As a board, we asked questions. We had suggestions. We gave recommendations. We gave advice. We tried to help Heather and the staff to arrive at a decision that would be both acceptable to the citizens and to the city management. For more than 90 minutes of discussion, we as a library board, after 90 minutes of discussion, the Library Advisory Board passed a unanimous decision in support of the proposal that our librarian gave to you this morning. I was sent by the board to express that unanimous motion to you, and also to tell you that in the future, when considering decisions, we hope that city management will trust us, advisory boards, that they will avail us of our recommendation, our advice, our input to the boards that we serve on. Instead of rejecting both our advice and our recommendations, we hope that they will listen to us to let us help them to face the important and serious problems that we both face. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other requests to speak?
No additional ones, Mayor.
Well, I'm going to adjourn the study session and call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session.
So moved.
Motion second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.